Tonight's topic, our fourth topic, is violence, military force, and the Jewish ambivalence towards power. Or, as I, in a way, wish I had entitled it, how religious Zionism became so militaristic. How and when did that happen? And what I'd like to try and do tonight is spend the first piece of this evening talking about the founding figures of religious Zionism, as we've talked about in several of these lectures, Rav Reines and Rav Kook, and the way in which, perhaps surprisingly, they embrace political activism wholeheartedly, but reject military activism entirely. That is, they recoil at the thought of embracing military power, let alone celebrating it. Then, after we spend some time on the two of them, we will look at Zvi Yehuda Kook and his circle and the way things turn 180 degrees in his thought and then as his thought spreads after the 1967 war. And I hope we'll be able to spend a little bit of time as well on the circle of criticism of Zvi Yehuda Kook in the religious Zionist world, which for various reasons gets sort of increasingly drowned out over time. So first, Reines. In order to understand how Reines thinks about the question of having an army, it's important to understand first that for Reines, one of the premises of his embrace of Zionism is that Zionism is, this is perhaps counterintuitive to many of us, not an innovation. That is, the Jewish people always have a responsibility to work towards their own safety and well-being. In other words, galut does not entail passivity and never did. Right? There is always an obligation to seek your own well-being. And Zionism, he argues, is merely a continuation of that obligation. Now, that may be historically naive, but it's theologically interesting, right? It's a way of taking something that has potential to seem innovative and perhaps therefore beyond the pale, and actually arguing that there's nothing new about it at all. This is in stark contrast, as we'll see, to Rav Kook, for whom Zionism is a dramatic innovation, but a divinely sanctioned innovation because it's part and parcel of the messianic unfolding. But what's implicit here, and this is really kind of the first point to kind of keep in mind, is that for Reines, and I think this is quite important to him, Zionism is not, as some religious critics charge, just a manifestation of secular European nationalism in Jewish form. It is, rather, a playing out of an age-old Jewish obligation to take responsibility for your own life, to seek your own well-being. But, and this is the crucial caveat for Reines, Jewish activism has to meet the standards set by the Jewish people's ethical and religious destiny and purpose in the world. Right? So on the one hand, the Jews have an obligation, an enduring obligation to take care of themselves, but they have to do it through means that don't violate their sacred calling and sacred purpose. This means, for Reines, no military power, period. The Jewish people are supposed to recoil from the use of physical force, because the use of such power would stand in total opposition to the Torah's ethical standards. So in other words, just to say this one other way, the Jews avoid politics and militarism traditionally, not because they're weak, but because that's what Judaism teaches and demands of them. Right? This is very important. In other words, the galut writing off of having an army is not a function of the Jews having no other choice, but rather it is an instantiation of a Jewish value. What is this sacred mission and destiny that the Jewish people have? And here Reines begins to be extremely interesting. He says that the project of the Jews, to which God has called them, is to articulate and embody a culture that offers a stark alternative to the dominant culture. The dominant culture of the world is the culture of the sword. The Jewish alternative is the culture of the book. And it can't be overstated for Rhinus that these two cultures stand in total opposition to one another, and they cannot be integrated or synthesized. Rhinus here is alluding to and interpreting a passage that you have on your sheets, the second quote, a line that appears in various forms in a couple places in rabbinic literature, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Hasayif Hasefer Yardu Kruchimin Hashamayim. I don't even want to elaborate on this, but just point it out. Rabbi Elazar says, the sword and the book came down from heaven together. And Rhinus' interpretation of what's going on in that image, there's more there, is that they descend to the world as the two alternatives for the kind of cultures human beings can create. A culture of the sword, which is fundamentally violent and animated by power, and a culture of the book, which is fundamentally intellectual, and for Rhinus, here Rhinus is, to the extent that many people in his time are influenced by Kant, the culture of the book is about the intellect triumphing over the raw, unbridled will, and especially the will to power. The essence of learning Torah, in other words, for Rhinus, is the creation and cultivation of an ethical personality. And he insists in his writing that repairing the world always begins with repairing the self, and that means triumphing over the will to control or hurt others. One of the things that's interesting, this is sort of a footnote, is that those religious Zionists who are most outspoken about a hesitancy to embrace physical force will quote again and again the famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, Ezehu Gibor HaKovesh Et Yitzro. Right? Who is a hero? Someone who is dafka able not to act on his will to power. In other words, the mission of the Jewish people for Rhinus is first and foremost ethical. In light of this, right, it doesn't surprise us to discover that for Rhinus, one of the central signs of the coming of the Messiah is the end of all wars. And this leads him to a kind of empirical rule. If there are wars in the world, we are not living in the Messianic Age. If there are wars in the world, we are not living in the Messianic Age. And as we'll see later, various people will re-invoke this sort of simple empirical theological principle to attack Zvi Yehuda Cook and his circle. But that's the basic premise. He says, I don't understand, right? The fundamental messianic aspiration is Lo yisa goy el goy cherev, right? Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. If that is still fundamentally the way the world works, well, clearly that's not the period that we're living in. And then Rhinus does something that for a Zionist may surprise you, and that is interesting in that Rhinus and Cook in different ways share this claim. Galut, Rhinus says, actually serves to help the Jewish people grow ethically. The function of Galut is that it helps the Jewish people grow ethically, and this in two ways. One, historical circumstances prevent us from participating in political life, which brings war with it. And two, and this is extremely interesting for a kind of identified Orthodox rabbinic figure to say, Chazal self-consciously and intentionally chose to spiritualize all military images and references in Tanakh. Right? He says, this was not an unconscious process. This is a conscious process. This is a decision they made to work on the ethical well-being of the Jewish people by spiritualizing all military images. So that, for example, if this sounds abstract, all kinds of images of military heroism in Tanakh now become metaphors for the life of the student in the Beit Midrash. And in fact, I always think it's interesting, I don't know that Rhinus says this, but that in the book of Joshua, right, what is the central thing that the rabbis use Joshua for? By a kind of somewhat tortured Midrash to suggest that Joshua is the source for the need to spend all your time learning Torah. Rhinus is chiddush, right, here is that this is a conscious process. Right? Many people, including many non-religious thinkers, will say, no, I mean, it's not conscious. you believe the Torah is in some way some truth, and you believe that some kind of approach to violence is the truth, and so you kind of de facto, that's what happens. You interpret unconsciously. Reinus actually, in a way, gives the rabbis, depending on where you stand here, more or less credit than that. And says, no, they knew exactly what they were doing. In other words, in contrast to a variety of Zionist thinkers, religious and non, Reinus doesn't lament the fact that the Jewish people had a long sojourn in exile. Rather, he emphasizes the important moral improvement that exile made possible. So, if you were to ask Reinus, what are the Jewish people supposed to do? He would say what it means to be a Jew in the world, for the time being, is to manifest the culture of the book in a world that is dominated by the culture of the sword. Or, maybe I'll say this a little bit differently, the Jewish people is supposed to anticipate by embodying now a culture, the culture of the book, that will one day dominate the world. And that's when the Messiah will have come. Right? There's a weird way in which there's a kind of idiosyncratic parallel here between some of what Rosenzweig says and Reinus here, the notion that waiting for the Messiah doesn't mean, as I think I talked about in one of these lectures, you know, watching TV and saying, what are you doing? I'm waiting for the Messiah. But no, actually embodying something that will one day be pervasive now. That's what it means to wait, to anticipate. Philosophers use the term prolepsis. You can look that up. It means anticipation, except you get tenure saying prolepsis. Now, in contrast to Rav Kook, right, as we'll see, Reinus, as I talked about last week, is, it seems, not a gradualist, right? This is not going to happen step by step, but rather he is, to use a term he would not have recognized, a kind of apocalypticist. That is, the transformation will be wrought by God, who will bring an end to one culture, the culture of the sword, and usher in the next culture, the culture of the book. There is no middle ground, and there is no intermediate stage. Reinus is a kind of absolutist about this. Some might say, maybe naively so. Some might say, maybe heroically so. Some might say, maybe naively and heroically at the same time. But, right, there's no intermediate stage. All of this, by the way, puts aside for a footnote discussion for some other time, how would the people I described as those who read Reinus in Straussian terms make sense of this? Those who think that Reinus really thought it was the Messianic period. And we'll leave that for another discussion. Now, of a piece with this, Reinus is very clear that the land of Israel is important, but the people of Israel are more so. Hence, his lack of difficulty, it seems, in accepting Uganda, at least temporarily. Right? Because if I can save Jewish people now, that trumps completely any claim or urgency about the land of Israel. What Reinus, in a way, is the paradigm of, and people will invoke him explicitly and implicitly a lot as they critique some of what happens to religious Zionism over time, is that Reinus is clear that on the one hand there are religious ideals and principles, and on the other hand there are realities. And having a fantasy about the former does not necessarily change the latter. What is called for is rootedness and realism, not some kind of fantastic metaphysical drama. We will hear this again and again as people begin to sort of rebel against what Zvi Yehuda's Kook and his circle do to religious Zionist thought. Now, I want to just sort of share one piece of, I think, interesting exegesis. The first source of the two sources on your sheet is a very famous line of Talmud that talks about the three oaths that the Jewish people take. And we don't have the time to go into this at length. Is it not there?
Only one source. There's the
Ketubot source. Oh, you don't have the Sefer V'Sayif? Okay, I don't know why that got cut off. Okay, sorry. I'm not sure exactly what happened there. The three oaths, the most important thing for now is that the Jewish people take an oath according to the Talmud, Shelo ya'alu b'choma, that they will not go up by force. I guess is probably the best translation of this. And In the history of confrontation between religious Zionist figures and Haredi thinkers, this text becomes unbelievably important. In some way, you could write an interesting intellectual history of the battle between religious Zionists and religious anti-Zionists as a meditation on what this Midrash means and how important this Midrash is. Is it just the Midrash, or is it some animating principle? Haredim, who are anti-Zionists, quote this text incessantly, right? You can't go up by force. And religious Zionists, in turn, find ways to say that oath is no longer applicable, right? Kalischer, who we talked about the first lecture, wonderfully says, who's talking about force? I'm talking about buying land from the Ottomans. I never said anything about by force. Now, Reines does something incredibly interesting with this text. He says, what remains of the three oaths in this day and age is the prohibition on force. We can re-engage politically, but we can't use force in achieving our ends. In other words, he takes a text that seems to be fundamentally about passivity and letting God have the sole prerogative for shaping history and says, this is not about human versus divine prerogative. This is about ethics. The three oaths apply in that they prohibit the Jewish people from having an army. That's all they mean now. And consistently, as a result of that, he says, yes, there is a mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz, of settling the land, but he points out, and he insists that even Nachmanides, the great source for this obligation, would agree with him. This is what he calls, in sort of idiosyncratic Hebrew of his time, halikicha haritzonit, which basically means buying the land. Of course, he says, it doesn't mean conquering the land, because that would be a contradiction in terms. Right? What it means, liyashev et haaretz, is to convince people to sell it to you. So in light of all this, and keeping in mind that Reines is dead by 1915, in light of all this, how does Reines imagine that a state will be possible? And that's an interesting question about a lot of the people in this generation. He has some kind of fantasy that the British Empire will protect the Jewish state to the extent that it needs protection, and that the Arabs will have no reason to fight. Okay? Now, I should say, by the way, I meant to say this at the beginning, that almost everything I'm saying tonight is derivative of the scholarly work of Eli Holzer, so I want to sort of give credit where it's due, and so my own spin on some of his writing. So we leave Reines with this incredibly interesting dichotomization of the book and the sword, the culture of the book and the culture of the sword. And we move to Abraham Isaac Cook, and I'll remind you that Abraham Isaac Cook and Yitzhak Yaakov Reines had a lot that they did not share in common, so much so that, as we saw, Michael Nehorai tried to argue that their Zionisms were two totally different Zionisms. One should be understood as religious Zionism, and one as what Nehorai calls Tzionut Geulatit, redemptive Zionism, redemptionist Zionism, maybe. But interestingly, on the question of military force and power, Reines and Cook are very close together. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, for Cook, in contrast to Reines, Zionism as a revolution, it's a transformation that is a central part of the unfolding of the coming of the Messiah. But, as if quoting from Reines, Cook immediately points out that Zionism must not, may not, bear arms or engage in military confrontation with the nations. Crucially, and this is where Cook is alternatively incredibly inspiring and, I think, almost tragically naive, he says, why can I make this argument? Because after all, we're living in the beginning of the Messianic era, where human nature is changing, and so there will never be a need for the use of military force. As he puts it, and I quoted in one of the past lectures, Ha'olam mitbasem, the world is becoming sweeter. And it is now possible for us to return to the land without exercising power or hurting anyone. Now, there's a kind of fundamental tension in Cook's thought that is worth thinking about. On the one hand, he sees a danger in nationalism. That is, it can lead to aggressiveness and belligerence, what in modern Hebrew is often called kochanut, right? It can lead to a kind of nationalism has the potential to be poison. On the other hand, he is confident that the Jewish people's unique qualities, refer back to the second lecture about the Jewish people being ontologically unique, they are somehow a unique entity in the world, their sgula will prevent that from happening. So it's this kind of interesting tension. On the one hand, he keeps warning, be careful if you're becoming a nationalist, that you don't become violent and immoral. And on the other hand, he assures himself that won't happen because there's some divine peace in us that will prevent that from happening. That's not a tension that he resolves. It sort of lives and breathes in his whole thought. And Rav Kook is careful to distinguish between biblical times and messianic times. It's true, he says, that in biblical times, the Jewish victories were military. But in messianic times, they will be spiritual. That was then, and this is now. In other words, in no way should biblical military battles be held up as some kind of paradigm for ideal Jewish behavior. They are behavior that was situated in a particular place and time based on the state of human beings at that time. In contrast to Rinus, in other words, Rav Kook has a clear sense of progress. And he argues, anticipating some of what I want to talk about next week, that contemporary yearning for justice, even among self-described secularists, is just one manifestation of this kind of pervasive human progress. Things are getting better. As I mentioned last time, right, there's two responses fundamentally in Europe to World War I. One is to believe that things are bound to get much better now, and the other is, how on earth can you talk about progress? Are you out of your mind? Right? Those are basically the two schools of thought about progress in light of World War I. Israel's galut, like for Rinus, is a transitional phase in which the centrality of power and force will pass from the world. Galut enables the Jewish people to grow in moral sensitivity. They need not be engaged in the ugliness of politics and power. No, I said that wrong. They need not to be engaged in the ugliness of politics and power in order for their moral cultivation to take place. Now, Rav Kook says this in some incredibly dramatic ways. In one essay of his, Hamilchama, The War, he actually says, this is an amazing passage where he talks about on the one hand, galut, exile, is forced upon the Jews. On the other hand, there is an internal assent. The Jewish people internally agree to go into exile because they understand that it doesn't make sense for a Jew to have power when power entails what he calls risha uvar bariut, wickedness and barbarism. So there's a kind of almost an agreement on the part of the Jewish people to live in exile until the world is redeemed enough so that they can once again return to their land without needing to exercise military force. Now, Cook thinks, that the messianic period is upon us, the challenge facing the Jewish people is to build a society that reflects the Torah's ethical ideals. The messianic situation means that it will be possible, and the mandate means that we now have to set about doing it. In striking parallel to Rinus, Cook says, the three oaths are a crucial ethical limit. Now, this is amazing. We're in the messianic period, he says, and yet the oaths still apply in this limited but important sense that we're still not allowed to act in a way that is unethical. Messianic activism, yes, but never in a way that is belligerent. Aggressiveness, he writes in one place, is a violation of Darka Shel Torah and Kedushatam Shel Yisrael. It is a violation of the way of Torah and the holiness of Israel. It's actually interesting. One could write a whole book about the relationship in the history of religious Zionism between meta-halachic arguments and halachic arguments. right? These guys, Cook and Rhinus, will consistently invoke metahalachic arguments. That is, what kind of human beings is the Torah interested in producing? What kind of people does it aim to cultivate? More than, oh, it's usher to do this, right? Their interest, it's forbidden to do this or that. They're interested in metahalachic arguments. Like Rhinus, Cook too says, there's a mitzvah of kibush ha'aretz, literally capturing the land. How does one do that? By purchasing it. Now, there's a kind of parallel in Cook to Rhinus, although his language is different. He says that in World War I, violent culture is exhausting itself. And the role of the Jewish people in World War I is to stand on the sidelines and allow that culture to basically drive itself into the ground and be ready to create and embody a different sort of politics when the time is right. In Cook's language, he talks about how the nations have Birkato shel Esav. They have Esav's blessing, whereas the Jewish people have Kolo shel Yaakov, the voice of Jacob. So what for Rhinus was a contrast between the book and the sword, for Rav Cook is a contrast between the blessing of Esau, or the hands of Esau on the one hand, and the voice of Jacob on the other. Now there's a tragic element in Cook and in many others, and I want to sort of mention it here and then maybe come back to it at the very end, and that is Cook argues that Jewish nationalism desperately needs religion, because without religion, Jewish nationalism will almost inevitably turn violent, aggressive, and militaristic. What it needs is the culture of Torah to constantly remind the Jewish people that nationalism can't mean becoming a nation like any other nationalism, where what really matters is military force and the heroes of the nation are soldiers. There is a challenge, in other words, always to be, he says, a goy tzaddik, right? A righteous nation. And one of the central projects of the religious Zionist world is to ensure that secular Zionists not lose sight of that. And maybe as we kind of come to an end of talking about Rav Cook, I should point out that for him, very unequivocally, the particularistic Jewish state is not the final stage, right? Universal redemption is the final stage of the Messianic period. The socio-cultural realities of the Jewish state that is formed will become a kind of religious and ethical model for the rest of the world. But crucially, it's a fundamentally harmonistic picture, meaning the Messianic period does not have room for, let alone entail, any conflict between the Jews and the other nations. And to put this in a kind of related way, universal aspirations are fundamental and constitutive of Jewish national identity. One interesting moment of this is that Rav Cook offers his own innovation on how to understand the pasuk, "Ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha," you should love your neighbor as yourself. He says, this refers not just, as some Jews have understood it, to relations between one Jew and another, not even between one Jew and every human being, as other Jewish sources have had it, but even to the relations between the Jewish people and other nations of the world. The Jewish nation has to love other nations who are its reah. Ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha means that not just individual Jews, but the Jewish people as a whole are called to universal love. Okay, so we have Rhinus and Cook, and in a certain way, if all you know about religious Zionism is through reading the New York Times, you might find it surprising, right, that the two sort of central intellectual figures in the birth of religious Zionism are basically apostles of nonviolence, right? It's quite interesting and important. Now, again, you may also say that it's naive, meaning it's very comfortable to argue this when you can still allow yourself a fantasy that it's going to go well. So, now, shifting gears for a second, what happens when you realize that you need to defend yourself? And that's the dilemma. It's that religious Zionists from around the 1930s through 1967 are wrestling with. And I want to very quickly just kind of draw a few lines about how they tend to think about this. Between the 1930s and 1967, moderation is basically the, I think, ideological and political rule of the day in the religious Zionist camp. The argument that you hear again and again in their sermons and writings is self-defense, yes, but with a constant attention to ethical limits. Interestingly, by the way, neither Reines nor Cook really distinguished between using military force for self-defense and using it in aggressive ways. Right? They still had this almost utopian understanding of, no, there's no need for power at all. Now what emerges is self-defense, yes, but again, a preoccupation with ethical limits. A struggle between the reality, on the one hand, of needing to use power to protect oneself, and a constant awareness that the Torah sets dramatic ethical constraints on the use of power, on the other. You find, then, that there are really important religious Zionist voices who are issuing regular warnings about manifestations of militarism that they feel and fear are emerging in the Zionist camp. So, for example, the religious Zionist world, by and large, is extremely strongly opposed to Etzel and Lehi, the sort of more militaristic non-Haganah parts of pre-Israeli, this is, I'm totally butchering this sentence, but of, let's say, pre-Israeli military forces. Some of them argue for pragmatic reasons, namely that it's ineffective and that it damages the unity of the nation. But others of them argue that what Etzel and Lehi are committed to are prohibited simply because it's immoral and prohibited by Torah. So I'll give you a couple of examples of this. A Mizrahi leader named Moshe Ostrovsky, known as Moshe HaMeiri, responds to attacks on Arabs that are reprisals for Arab attacks on Jews. These are kind of attacks on any old Arabs they can find, by saying, these are toevot. Even the more refined of the Gentile nations, he says, know that one does not behave like this, let alone you, who are in theory rooted in the culture of Judaism. And Moshe Una, who we talked about in the first lecture, a member of Knesset from Mafdal, once a state is formed, says, yes, there is a mitzvah of settling the land on the one side, and there's also realism and ethics on the other side, and we always have to choose the side of realism and ethics. And by the way, stop kidding yourself that there's never going to be any conflict. It's a very important claim. In other words, he says, yes, there might be a claim about settling the land, but there are also other claims. And what it means to be mature, a mature adult, right, is to struggle with conflicting claims. That's what kind of it means to be alive. I would even say this in a slightly different way. That's, for Una, what it means to recognize that you're not living in a messianic era, right? Is that you have to deal with conflicting claims. Thomas Sowell, the American neoconservative thinker, has a wonderful statement about this. I think it's actually, I don't think he said it in the context of theology, but it's one of the most astute comments about theology that I've ever heard, which is, he says, in this world, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. That is a very good definition of Olam Hazeh, in my view, right? That's actually what it means not to live in a messianic period. Now, in general, among Mizrahi thinkers, reality dictates self-defense. But again, be careful lest you turn force into some kind of political principle, and worse yet, lest it come to govern the ethos that you create. Militarism is antithetical to Torah. And a whole variety of Mizrahi thinkers find themselves reminding both religious and secular Zionists that the divine promise of the whole land of Israel does not necessarily translate into a concrete political program for right now. Part of what it means to be an adult is to realize that you can't have everything you want. Right? That's the premise. Now, interestingly, so from the 1930s to 1967, the overarching ethos of the religious Zionist world is largely about holding to a politically moderate position and understanding itself as articulating a kind of ethical critique of the danger of what will happen if having an army for self-defense then translates into valorizing or celebrating the fact of having an army. And then the revolution comes, and the revolution is named Tzvi Yehuda Cook. In his early days, it's important to point this out, in his early days, Tzvi Yehuda worries, as his father's student, about the dangers of nationalism turning into chauvinism. Modern Hebrew has a wonderful phrase for this, which English doesn't have, le'umiyut versus le'umanut, right? Nationalism versus national chauvinism. We don't really have an English way of capturing that. This means, by the way, neither, I don't know if Tzvi Yehuda ever used that word, but that word is very current in contemporary Israeli usage. The means to redemption have to themselves be worthy of the Jewish people's ethical and religious calling, a position that Tzvi Yehuda will, I think, consciously or not, come to abdicate over time. The means you use to achieve redemption themselves have to be worthy of redemption. And yet there's a dramatic shift in Tzvi Yehuda that happens sometime in the 1940s as he learns about the Shoah. And he basically comes to the position that Gentiles do not understand that our revival is also for their benefit. And he begins to assert with some anger, our redemption will come whether or not they like it. Al apam va'al chamatam. Whether or not they like it. In other words, he begins to leave behind what I described as his father's harmonistic perspective, where the messianic unfolding means that there is no conflict between Jews and Gentiles. In this stage of the messianic unfolding, it seems that there is, in fact, deep and, at least for the time being, irreconcilable conflict. Now, after the 1940s, the essence of messianic thinking for Tzvi Yehuda becomes not thinking about the universal goals of Jewish messianism, but rather, and here's where we begin to move in an interesting and new direction, the essence is cultivating belief in Israel's God-endowed strength. God's presence is manifest in the Jewish national revival, and the main job of the Gentile nations is not to get in the way. From 1948 onward, Tzvi Yehuda begins to be preoccupied with the meaning of the Jewish people having an army. This radicalizes dramatically after 1967 and the military victory, but it's already there beforehand. Jewish power, he says, is a manifestation of the uniqueness election, the segula, of Israel. Jewish power is God's presence in the Jewish people. Now, it's this very interesting thing that's worth kind of understanding. How could Tzvi Yehuda have thought that he was continuing his father's Torah in saying this? And what I want to suggest, and here again, this is more Eli Holzer's idea than mine, what I want to suggest is that for Rav Kook, the father, political activism is folded into the larger messianic perspective. For Tzvi Yehuda, the son, military power, in a similar way, is folded into the larger messianic view. The premise, in other words, is that historical developments can and have to be folded in to a narrative about divine providence and will. Or to put this in a different way, the form of the argument is similar, even though the content of the argument is in some ways antithetical. Right? In other words, you could imagine Rav Kook saying, I understand the structure of your argument, but filling that structure of an argument with the content of celebrating military power stands in direct opposition to the content of what I saw as the heart of the Jewish people's project. Right? So Tzvi Yehuda represents this very interesting dialectical rupture and continuity with his father's way of thinking. Now, in what I think is in some way the most poignant moment of religious Zionist writing, and it shows you, in a way, where Tzvi Yehuda and his circle are headed, Tzvi Yehuda turns to the same midrash that I mentioned in the context of Rhinus, the one that mysteriously disappeared from your page, and says, the book and the sword come down together because they need to be integrated. It is simply impossible to be a man of the book without being a man of the sword, nor a man of the sword without being a man of the book. Ish ha-Torah hu ish ha-Tzava. The man of the Torah is the man of the army. Now, a messianic fervor, as we've talked about, overtakes the country after 67, although, and this is, as I talked about in the first lecture, what's interesting is most of the country recovers from that messianic fervor very quickly, and Tzvi Yehuda and his circle don't notice. And it's actually one of the interesting problems is that it takes them a very long time to figure that out. The very fact, Tzvi Yehuda argues, that Israel now has military power is itself a manifestation of the messianic unfolding and of God's providential concern for Jewish history. Now, if your reaction to this is to be undialectically revolted, I want to just suggest that that's fine, except I actually think it's important to situate this a little bit in the context of post-Holocaust theology and psychology, right? I think Tzvi Yehuda's move here is not fully understandable outside the context of an extraordinary degree of rage about what Jewish powerlessness made possible. Now, that is not... I just want to be clear. I'm not making that statement as a justification of anything. I'm making it as an explanation for some of the processes, psychic and social, that might explain it. Now, where all this cosmic messianism, messianic maximalism, as we called it last week, gets really dangerous, is that for Rav Kook the father, the messianic period contained an ideal state to be dreamed about. For Tzvi Yehuda the son, all of these hopes and fantasies now get attached to a concrete political reality. This very concrete state, not some ideal of one day Medinat Yisrael, which will be Kisei Hashem Ba'olam, right? None of that. Now, it's actually a very concrete political entity. This state simply is a realization of messianic hope. As we talked about last time, this state is a divine state. This leads Tzvi Yehuda to allow himself to say things like, here I'll quote it in English and then in Hebrew, the state is completely holy, it has no defects. The state is completely holy, it has no defects. Yesh davar ikari klali, hamedinahi kula kodesh, ve'ein bashum pgam. And whatever pgamim, whatever faults it might have, are incidental, and don't touch the essence, which is pure holiness. Now, from here we move to the argument that sovereignty is a central religious value. Sovereignty is at the core of the Jewish people's religious aspirations. And here, I just want to point your attention to an exegetical transformation that Tzvi Yehuda enacts that, personally, I find shocking. And it is this. The meaning of Chilul Hashem, he says, is in the land of Israel not being under Jewish sovereignty. The meaning of Chilul Hashem is now no longer fundamentally about ethics or interpersonal relations. It is about the Jewish people's concession that other people can rule the land, or as he says in one of his, now I can't help editorializing, terrifying formulations, Kvod Yisrael, hu kvod Hashem. The honor of Israel, I don't know if that means the nation or the people, I assume it means both, and I'm sorry, the nation or the state, is the honor of God. This means, by the way, that the center of religious life has now been moved from ritual or ethics to politics. Politics is now the scene where the heart of the religious life plays itself out. And this is not so far off from what a variety of religious sanctions of totalitarianism begin to look like. Now, the next step, and this is where we begin to get to the point where I begin to imagine Rav Kook recoiling in horror, right? So if sovereignty is the manifestation of God in the world, then the military has to be seen as kadosh. So we have this process of sanctifying the military. Every military victory, this is amazing. Now think about this. This is the converse to what I said before. Every military victory of Tzal is a Kiddush Hashem in the theological term. From there, Svi Yehuda goes to the sanctification of weapons. As one Gush Emunim poster puts it, an Israeli military tank is a Davar Shebikdusha, just as a pair of tefillin is. Or, in what I think is the worst sentence I have ever read a religious Zionist write, the multiplication of weapons in Eretz Yisrael brings the Shekhinah back to it. Now, it's important to stop and ask, what is this? Like, how did this happen? And I actually think that a lot could be said about that. Interestingly, with all the ink that has been spilled in trying to understand Tzvi Yehuda and the emergence of his circle, there's still a lot more to say about this. I think one would have to talk about the trauma of the 1940s, the very real sense that, you know what, Rav Kook? The nations don't like us. Not only don't they not like us, right? Either they genocide us, or they turn the other way while they genocide us. And 1967 becomes a way of imagining God's return to history. Things begin to make sense again. We have not been abandoned. Maybe the world hates us, but God surely doesn't. And that basically kind of takes on a life of its own and spins out of control. Now, something that I have been thinking about a lot, and I'm just sort of sharing with you that I have no clear thought about this. I'm trying to understand, in my own mind, the relationship between, is this a consequence of a messianism that, in contrast to some of the messianisms we talked about last time, is in some fundamental way not this worldly, that is a messianism that is fundamentally metaphysical? Or is it a result of what we talked about in the second lecture, ontological essentialism, the notion that the Jewish people and the land of Israel are other than any other people or any other land? Is it simply the result of a particularly uncomplicated thinker? Is it some nexus of those things? How much weight should we assign to each of those? I think all of those are very interesting questions. And the way that I'm trying to lay this out is you can sort of imagine, depending on what your values are, right, a progression or a descent where the moment you start sanctifying as utterly holy the state in front of you as opposed to some ideal, then you're actually on a very short path to sanctifying wars and declaring them all holy wars, sanctifying an army, sanctifying weapons, and then the next step is that we're no longer talking about self-defense only. We're no longer talking about an explanation of why military force became necessary, but a prescriptive embrace of it. Military power, in other words, and this is Tzvi Yehuda's revolution in religious Zionism, and it's really important to understand that this really is a revolution that is his, right? He's the first person for whom military power is not in some fundamental way a necessary evil, but rather a lechatchila obligation as part of what it means to revive oneself as a nation. Now, in contrast to Reines and Rav Kook, mitzvat kibush haaretz, the mandate to capture the land, is understood as mitzvat kibush haaretz, the mandate to conquer the land militarily. And among some of Tzvi Yehuda's students, I think actually in Tzvi Yehuda himself, it is not just any mitzvah, but is rather a kind of meta-mitzvah. No other halachic principle can stand in its way, including pikuach nefesh. Now again, just try for a minute to imagine Reines and Rav Kook hearing this argument. Now, maybe in the next logical step to this, some of of Tzvi Yehuda's students, we'll quote here Shlomo Aviner, take one more step and say, even in a time when there is ostensibly peace, we ought to launch war to capture the rest of the land. After all, that is the ultimate meta-mitzvah. Shlomo Aviner, who amazingly is actually, in our time, a moderate in the circle of Tzvi Yehuda's students. Now, in other words, what we have here is, right, a messianic drama that comes with a total lack of concern with political reality, right? By the way, I actually make that statement not normatively, simply as a description. In other words, Shlomo Aviner, for example, will say, in this day and age, our politics should be animated by being willing to rely on divine intervention. And this will lead many of his critics, Tzvi Yehuda's critics, to say, what Jewish theology ever said it was okay to take actions in the world that depend on miraculous intervention? Mordechai Breuer, who some of you know as a Israeli figure trying to struggle with the meaning of biblical criticism, famously says, I actually think the category of Ein Somchin al Hanes, of we don't rely on miracles, is pretty much an enduring religious principle, and I don't know what planet your theology is coming from. Now, the father, remember, as we said, right, articulated consciously or not, I'm not really sure, the tension between warning about the danger of militarism on the one hand and confidence that the Jewish people's segula, uniqueness, would protect its ethics on the other hand. For Tzvi Yehuda, the dialectic is largely gone. The segula, the uniqueness of Israel, ends up meaning that essentially whatever Israel does is by definition holy and ethical. After all, the state is the manifestation of God's presence on earth. What I'd like to do for the last little bit of this lecture is talk a little bit about the voices, or a couple of the voices, in the religious Zionist camp who watch this happening and basically start screaming Gewalt. And by the way, this begins to happen within months of the victory in 1967. People who begin to say, oh my God, right? What is happening here? How is it possible that you, Tzvi Yehuda, are going to get away with saying that this is the authoritative interpretation of your father's worldview? Or maybe the fact that you think so is an argument about how nuts it is to argue that we're in the process of some metaphysically unfolding messianic drama. So I want to take a minute to talk about a man named Pinchas Rosenblit and the fact that none of you have heard of him says something about where we've come in the unfolding of religious Zionism. Pinchas Rosenblit comes out by the end of 1967, comes out slashing against what he calls Habulmus HaMishichi, the messianic craze that now threatens to overtake religious Zionism. And he says, now sounding exactly like Rav Reines, the Messiah will have come when there is peace and there are no more wars. That is the only empirical test for the coming of the Messiah. What planet could you possibly be on where, A, you're indifferent to the fact that there are still lots of wars everywhere, and B, you're now celebrating your capacity to go to war, when the whole point of the Messianic period is the end of war? Rambam, he reminds us, says that the Messiah will have come when everyone worships God together. What that means is there are good relations between Israel and the nations of the world. Your total indifference to what everyone else thinks actually, again, only makes the point that we're not living in a messianic period. Not only is the world not redeemed, we're not redeemed because you're saying the things you're saying. All of this messianic talk, he argues, blinds us. And here Rosenblit is a really interesting character. It is blinding us to the reality of the sufferings of our enemy and the refugee problem caused by our victory. This is early 1968. A religious Jew is obligated to confront the pain caused by wars always, even necessary and just wars. And then he points out, almost addressing Tzvi Yehuda, history is filled with people who were convinced that God was on their side militarily. Do you really want to be like them? Is that the company you want to keep in the history of humankind? And then, finally, he says, we should never use religious ideas as a way of turning away from the realities on the one hand and the moral demands, on the other hand, of this world. Human responsibility for the morality of our behavior is not something that somehow goes away. And again, Moshe Una, comes to the scene. We'll talk about him more in the final lecture, and says, you know, the religious Zionist world seems to be totally blind to the ways that it is being corrupted. Secular nationalism takes religious concepts and transforms them into crudely nationalistic ones. And now, we're the ones articulating that vision. And he adds, as a religious Jew, I, for one, see the pursuit of peace as the highest religious goal there is. Now, it may be in the interest of time, I won't do this, although I'll take a couple of minutes and talk about one other critic here, Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. One of his claims to fame is that when he is elected to be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, the person over whom he wins that position is a man named Joseph Soloveitchik. Moshe Avigdor Amiel, who this is earlier, he dies in 1946. But I just want to point out something because it returns to the irony with which I would like to end. He argues in characteristically ferocious terms. He was an extremely gifted polemicist. And when you find yourself agreeing with him, you find it totally endearing. And when you find yourself disagreeing with him, you find it over the top. He says, modern political nationalism is a form of idolatry. Why is it idolatry? Because it privileges the nation and the collective over the individual. It loses sight over the inherent holiness of an individual. This and this alone, he says, enables nations to send countless people into battle to kill and be killed. And worse, it is idolatrous, he says, because it takes us back to the biblical era when all we have are radically particularistic territorial gods, right? And in the end, the danger of, I want to underline this, the danger of secular nationalism is that we'll end up with a radically particularistic territorial god. Religion, Rav Amiel argues, is the very opposite of this, because the heart of theology is the claim that the single individual human being is at the center of its concerns. Those of you who are in the yeshiva think I made that up. Rav Amiel said it too. And he makes the case, monotheism, humanism, and universalism are all one seamless web. Monotheism, humanism, and universalism are one seamless web. Now, this is a guy who in some ways would have defined himself as a Haredi. I want to sort of make that clear. He's not, in the idiom of contemporary Israel, reformy. Now, you should note, right, Jewish religious nationalism, Rav Amiel suggests, aims to teach moral universalism, whereas secular nationalisms are paths to idolatry and limitless bloodshed. The argument he makes is that, therefore, secular Jewish nationalism is actually a form of assimilationism. That is, it is an internalization of the worst aspects of general culture, that is, hatred of the other. The biggest failing of secular Zionism, as he understands it, again, he's dead in 1946, is that it ends up embracing a culture of violence and aggressiveness. The argument, and it would be interesting to have had Tzvi Yehuda engage with this, the later Tzvi Yehuda, secular nationalism, he argues, is rooted in hatred of Gentiles. After all, its fundamental premise is anti-Semitism. Religious nationalism, in contrast, is rooted in the universal love that is a logical entailment of being a monotheist. So, Rav Amiel suggests, religious Zionism can only authentically be Zionist if it is the voice of moral criticism within the Zionist project. That is, in a sense, what people like Pinchas Rosenblut and Moshe Una and quite a few others, those people who after 1967 create groups like Oz V'Shalom, Netivot Shalom, later Meimad, that is essentially the mandate, whether they've read Rav Amiel or not, that they understand that the job of the religious part of the Zionist project is to be its kind of moral police. And again, here's another religious Zionist thinker who says, Galut purifies us morally. We needed to be in exile in order for our universalism to emerge. And we needed the temple to be destroyed in order for us not to think of God as simply and exclusively located in one place. Self-defense, he says, here he's a little bit later than Rhinus and Cook, is permitted, but be careful. You should be revolted at your need to act in this way, even if it's right and necessary. You should be revolted at your need to act in this way, even if it's right and necessary. In other words, military force is a necessary evil. Precisely where Tzvi Yehuda, the notion that Tzvi Yehuda abandons. It is absolutely prohibited, Rav Amiel suggests in one of his more dramatic formulations, to kill one innocent person in any circumstance. Now, many very good moral philosophers would call that claim and its absolutism into question, but it's an extremely important voice in the religious Zionist conversation. And at one point, Rav Amiel allows himself a formulation that I've been thinking a lot about this week, where he says that even if we thought that gratuitous violence would bring the redemption, we would then have to say, no thank you. Aleinu litchot hageula hazot b'shtei yadayim, v'lo lihigael b'dam. Right? It is our obligation to reject such notions of redemption out of hand, and never to be redeemed through blood, never to be redeemed by the spilling of blood. And I returned to Rav Amiel here really as a kind of counterweight to what Tzvi Yehuda does to the Zionist, to large parts of the religious Zionist world. Now, there's a lot to say about what all this might mean in the future. I hope to talk about some of that in the sixth and final lecture. I will just say one last closing thought, which could itself be its own lecture, which is that I think that one of the things you find now in large pockets of the students and grand students of Tzvi Yehuda Cook is a really profound theological and ideological confusion that comes from the fact that the very army that they declared holy and without defect has now employed its force against them. Right? That is the meaning of Amona, right? That is the meaning of the evacuation in Amona, where the army that is holy and without defect now has opened fire, not literally, but has been, let's say, physically forceful with those people who are the only people who understand its true metaphysical value. So this means that students and grand students are faced with the challenge of either A, finding another way to internalize this development into some overarching messianic drama, or, as in the case of a small pocket of religious Zionist thinkers, and they're not doing this for liberal reasons, I want to make it clear, who say, this army is not the army we talked about. Just as this government is not the state we talked about. And the beginning of that rupture will be very interesting to see where that unfolds. It's very hard to talk about sort of theological unfolding when it's all of 5 years old. Okay, I'll stop there and we have some more time than usual for questions and comments. Are the microphones around? Great. Anyone should feel free. Wow.
Rabbi, this is fascinating. I'm curious, especially about the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv and Kutz people by and large live in Jerusalem. You talked very little about Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. I'm kind of curious about your take on the role of those two cities in all of this, in terms of how it forms their thought.
I don't think I have a good answer for you. Meaning, I think that's a very interesting question. I wonder to what extent it's an anachronistic question. I'm not sure about that. Let me get back to you on that. I don't want to like make up an answer. I have to think about that more. Yeah. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I'll just say this. I'm not sure that Jerusalem then means what you might imagine Jerusalem means now in terms of like that being the place where all the thinking is going on. Remember that many of Rav Cook's most important essays are written in Jaffa. Right, which is not a hotbed of religious life, to say the least. But I want to think about your question more. It's actually very interesting. And actually, as you may know, in the last few years, there's a lot of scholarship emerging on the cultural meaning of Tel Aviv around its centennial, I guess. Ben, you were going to...
So you talked about how the leadership for military guidance. How does that lead to, you might have covered this in earlier lecture, how does that lead to yeshivas and shall be the most important? I didn't see the connection between those two things.
So, at the risk of, you know, giving you a very unsatisfying answer, refer to lecture 2, where I talk about that at great length. Okay, I'd rather not sort of just summarize that now in one sentence, but that's, yeah, John.
I also refer to another lecture, but...
it's the easy way to deflect questions, right?
The first, Rob Cook based a lot of what he believed in on the notion that he was living in a messianic age.
Right.
What made him think that he was living in a messianic age? Very basic question. Was it the settlement of the land of Israel itself, or was there something else?
Refer to lecture 3. But I would, you know, there's a lot of things there. I think the very emergence of the urge among the Jewish people and the plausible possibility of returning to the land is one. The development of this sort of sense that World War I is dramatically changing the world. Those are the two main pieces. And as I think I talked about last time, this strand in rabbinic literature that talks about how the sign of the messianic unfolding is the land returning to bearing fruit, that whole kind of Zionist mythology about the land is now again bearing its fruit and the swamps are being drained and all that kind of stuff, you know, allows Rav Cook to point to these Ma'amarei Chazal, to these rabbinic statements, and say, oh, look, and that's very common. Many people who want a sort of theological sanction, it's amazing how important that image becomes. The notion of the Haketz HaMeguleh, the revealed end of history, is when the land again begins to bear its fruit. That's quoted all over the place. I thought you were going to ask me what I think is a more provocative question that I'm going to answer even though you didn't ask it. Answer by saying it's a very good question, even though you didn't ask it. which is, when someone like Rav Cook insists that we are living in a messianic age because we now live in a time where the world is becoming sweeter and where it is possible for power to be reengaged without it leading to devastating consequences, what would that person say in light of the Shoah? Would that person say, okay, I'm a Zionist all the more, but I'm going to revise some of my assumptions about the state of the world and how it's unfolding? Would that person say, actually, I'm committed to the view that the Jews can take power when the world is fundamentally corrupt, so I'm no longer going to be a Zionist? What would that person say after watching the Tzvi Yehudaization of religious Zionism, right? Has the project of religious Zionism been so sullied that it's irredeemable and it itself proves that we're not living in the Messianic period? In other words, we find ourselves, those of us who are willing to entertain those questions, you know, wondering what a thinker who's dead in 1935 would make of a world that still needs to live through the 1940s, 1948, 1967, the Lebanon War in 1982, two intifadas, right? And in a way, if nothing else, it points to the difficulty of fantasizing that we can sort of know what someone then would have thought now, right? Because it's almost like saying the distance between now and 1935 is about as big a 75-year distance as you can imagine in the history of the world. And Tzvi Yehuda is surely one manifestation of how you might confront those questions, but it is only that. And Tzvi Yehuda's circle is largely, I think, unwilling to ask those questions because they're convinced they know the answer. I think the jury is out for those willing to entertain those questions. Ross, please.
You may point into the last lecture in your series. I'm wondering, you're talking about historically, project 7 years in the future, what they might say about what could happen. But I'm wondering if there's historical project, did you see these early thinkers as sort of what role they have today in kind of maybe thinking about these political realities and how you sort of imagine the conversation going?
Well, okay, I hope, talk more about that in the last lecture, but I'll say a couple of things for now in response to that. I actually think that, unfortunately, both Reines and Cook are so absolutist in their differentiation between the culture of the book and the culture of the sword, the hands of Esau and the voice of Jacob, that I'm not sure they, in themselves, provide material to go back to and build a Zionist worldview on. I think what they do is serve as a kind of crucial counterstatement to the monolithization, let's call it, of religious Zionism in this particularly, I think, mutated direction that it took. Meaning, I think, in other words, one can turn to Cook and Reines to say, right, the valorization, sanctification, metaphysicalization of Jewish military power is, let's say, dangerous and pernicious. But I don't think they themselves do the work. I think what you need, to some extent, is also the work of some of the people post-1936 and post-1967 who are more outspoken moral critics. But even they, I think one of the great failings of a lot of these pockets of religious Zionist liberal universalism is that very few of those people develop full-blown Zionist worldviews. They're content being critics. And I think when you think about the sheer romance of the messianic drama that Cook, father and son enable people to buy into, it's the lack of a coherent worldview that is actually, and an articulated, unapologetically articulated worldview, that is what is sorely needed. That is why, now you don't have to come to my last lecture, that is why I think in certain pockets, and it's really only that for now, you have the turn to people like Soloveitchik, in smaller pockets to people like Heschel, in even smaller pockets to people like David Hartman, who are theologically committed Zionists who are non- or anti-messianic, and who therefore have a dramatically this-worldly conception of the need to deal with this-worldly realities. But if that's a sociological question, I don't see any reason to be optimistic. The only reason to be optimistic is tragic, which is that, as I mentioned last time, the disaster that will unfold among the religious Zionist camp when there is a Palestinian state more or less on 1967 borders, which they are the only people left who don't understand is going to happen, right? What that will mean over time for them, anybody's guess. It's anybody's guess. It's just unclear. As we talk about, will they become Haredim, a lot of them? Will they become secular? Will they search for a different religious Zionism? I mean, one thing we know from social science is that predictions are always wrong. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody knows how violent it will be. Nobody knows how theologically devastating it will be. And it's, in light of some of what we've talked about, it's a little terrifying to contemplate. But how's that for a cheery thought? Yeah, please, and then these two comments. Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I don't really know the answer to that, you know, and this is a joke, so don't take this as a criticism, you know. I've never been one of those people who's interested in sort of the gossipy side of the history of ideas, and I know you're not asking that, but because I actually think it's sort of funny. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you. That's my answer to that question, besides that I'm actually not that sure, is that yesh v'yesh. Meaning, I think that there were people who would have run the other way rather than daven in a shul with Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who they saw as basically the person who murdered religious Zionism and maybe Zionism more broadly. But to what extent do religious Zionists share some sense of still being a minority and in some sense in this together? I don't know. I think it's a really interesting sociological question. I'd like to know that now. Here's what I would say about this, that I think that part of what happens to extremely radicalized groups is that they, Dafka, turn on each other with a vengeance. So that, I mean, this may sound to many of us like, okay, you know, minor in the scheme of things, although it's actually profoundly not minor, but those of Tzvi Yehuda's circle who were unequivocally opposed to Seiruv, to refusing military orders, have found themselves to some degree ostracized in some pretty strong ways. I mean, Shlomo Aviner's life was almost destroyed by people. I'm not talking about, there have been many scandals around Shlomo Aviner, and I'm not trying to exonerate him from them, but the notion that we're going to find a way to say this person is not a posek halacha, and he doesn't know anything. Why? What's the real reason? Because he basically said, look, the bottom line is, if you disobey military orders, the whole Zionist project is over. You can't do that. So what I actually don't know the answer to is, would Moshe Una have been willing to go to shul with Tzvi Yehuda Cook? I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it's a very interesting question, and I don't know that anyone has ever really kind of, as a historical project, engaged that. You know, I'm sorry, one more little sort of footnote to this, which is interesting, is when Rav Yehuda Amital, who really was the one person from this circle who basically walked away from it ideologically, right? Yehuda Amital, some of you may know, one of the most important statements of the Tzvi Yehuda circle's theology was a book by Yehuda Amital called Hama'alot Mimamakim, a theological statement of Cookian, Tzvi Cookian Messianic Zionism. And over time, when Yehuda Amital saw the moral damage that that theology was doing and the political damage it was doing, he basically walked away and essentially said, this circle was wrong, right? We're not living in Mashiach Zeit. And yet, it was extremely hard for a lot of people to walk away from him because the guy literally invented the Hesder Yeshivot, right? And so, at his funeral last year, they were all there. Most of them, I think, probably hadn't spoken to him in a very long time. But these things are very common. By the way, here's another piece of this. The people who show up to funerals is a whole other dimension, right? Davening with someone, right? Ask someone who was at Abraham Joshua Heschel's funeral, right? About all his cousins from Brooklyn in their black hats who hadn't talked to him, right? They're all JTS for the funeral. If someone's dead, in a way, it's easier to reclaim them. They're not arguing with you anymore. But anyway, yeah, please. So that was a total non-answer to your question, other than to say it's a very interesting question.
Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that...
You're wrong.
Yeah. I think that last week when we talked about Messianism, you did not bring the second half of the second chunk of Kufid al-Hanal that talks about being maybe case or being market case. And I mean, I'm wondering, how does specifically Theodore Cook deal, actually no, both Cooks deal with their actions bringing...
Wait, with their actions bringing Mashiach?
With their theology saying that it's the time of Mashiach is now, and by doing the Zionist project, we won't be bringing Mashiach, and that could be problematic in Kibbutz.
Oh, okay. In other words, not to be docheik et haketz. So, not to be sort of hastening the end. So the answer that they all give to that is, I think, actually very simple, right? Which it may beg the question for one who's not already on the inside. But what do you mean, dochek the kates? There are all kinds of signs that it is the kates. I'm sorry, the end, right? So Tzvi Yehuda, in one of his sort of famous sermonic operas, says, what do you mean, techikata kates? God is the one who's saying, come. What are you talking about? I don't understand. We have the land of Israel, We have an army. We have sovereignty. The land of Israel is bearing its fruit. What are you talking about? Now, what people do say, which is not exactly your question, but I want to sort of point that out, Rav Kook, the father, I'm always tempted to say the real Rav Kook, Rav Kook the father says, you know, our moral choices do affect when this process will fulfill itself. And actually, the person who says that, you know, dramatically in the 1980s is Yehuda Amital, who says, yeah, the only thing that this being a messianic period could be a guarantee for, if you want to argue that, is that, yeah, one day it will lead to redemption. But you keep behaving the way you're behaving, that one day could be a very long time from now. So I think I would say to you here, and I can already picture your face before I'm going to say it, right? So the question is, to what extent is an Agadah authoritative? So then you'll ask the question, wait a second, I thought the Shalosh Shavuot were authoritative. And then the question becomes, which Agadah? There's a lot to say about that. We could talk about that. But you know, the history of messianic movements is filled with interpreting, emphasizing. You know what, actually, let me just make that a much broader statement. The history of all human movements that are interested in the past, right, is filled with people who choose to dilate on emphasize certain texts and find ways to explain away the authority of others. By the way, if you think that's not true, read the Babylonian Talmud. What does the Babylonian Talmud on about every page? This applies, this doesn't apply, right? And the truth is, as I will talk about in the last lecture, I would actually argue that all religious communities are engaged in something similar, right? The choice of which texts to take as authoritative and which texts to simply describe as non-authoritative, and which text to take as authoritative but say they don't mean what you think they do. Every religious community does that. The only question is whether they admit it to themselves and others. I would argue that the difference about different kinds of Jews in modernity, one of them is, it's not the only difference, but one of them is, who's willing to be honest about that? Yeah. Eric. Save the day, baby. Yeah? Yeah?
Do any of these arguments, obviously not that you refer to this, but do any of these arguments enjoy political salience on the part of religious federalists today? So do you hear them? Are they cited in the Knesset?
You mean the Tzvi Yehuda ones or the critics?
No, I know that, Tzvi Yehuda, I suppose. No, I'm saying that the first two don't make any sense in the context. There's a powerful state there, and that's why we have settlers. What I'm saying is to what degree can these arguments be considered part of the mainstream political debate and the mainstream expression all the way?
I'm still not totally certain. If
so
you're
we're having a theological discussion, but I'm interested in how much this theology blends into present.
Okay. So let me actually say one thing about Tzvi Yehuda's circle, which maybe is helpful and important here. One of the things that some scholars have argued, I don't know if they're right, actually, and this is not because I'm doubting them, it's because I actually don't know enough to know, that some scholars have suggested is that one of the things that Rav Kook, the father, sort of consciously did was he didn't weigh in on every political question that emerged in the yeshuv. He weighed in on the ones that he thought were of sort of enormous moral and theological consequence. One of the things that happens in Tzvi Yehuda circle is as we talked about in a couple of lectures already, the translation of theological ideas into a concrete political program, so much so that the claim is that these theological ideas have very concrete political implications for all kinds of small military and geopolitical decisions. So it certainly has salience and relevance to those parties that are influenced by Tzvi Yehuda. So what was the sort of post-1967 or the 1980s version of the NRP, right? These ideas matter a lot. And yet, it is interesting that there are moments even in the biggest kind of messianic craze, the bul mushamshichi that we talked about, is there are moments when the rabbis in the Tzvi Yehuda circle order the Knesset members to vote in a particular way, and they won't do it. Which is interesting, right? The most dramatic example is, if I remember correctly, after the Y Accords, right? Avraham Shapira, who's sort of the leading rabbinic figure, and in theory, the sort of posek for Mafdal, the like religious decision maker for them, for the NRP, says you have to leave this government. And they stay. Which is interesting. So I don't know if that really answers your question. I think these ideas have enormous salience, tragically, in one way, which is that large segments of Israeli elected officials are terrified of what it would mean to confront this camp head on. That, I think, has enormous salience, right? It's not an embrace of those ideas, but it's a fear of them.
I get that, but one has a sense that the debate is, well, we can't trust these people, and it's too dangerous, and we need to protect our security. How much do you hear, no, this is actually the fulfillment of the meaning of our
Okay, great. So let me...
Here,
okay, good.
We have no right to do that, even if they wanted to live happily next door.
Okay. Thank you. This is a great opportunity for me to have like a three-minute tirade that I'll try to organize as well as I can. And then we'll end. Okay? The first thing I would say is that I think that for many American journalists, some of whom are friends of mine, talk about the Zionist right, the Israeli right, as if they're all a bunch of kind of messianic, greater land of Israel types. That is false on its face. They are, I mean, a good example of this is the recent Andrew Sullivan, right? Where Bibi Netanyahu is a supporter of the greater land of Israel. Andrew Sullivan can only say that because he actually knows nothing about Zionism, right? That's totally false. Now, you know what? I should actually caveat that a little bit. It's not false about the ideological ancestors of Bibi Netanyahu. I think it's actually false about Bibi Netanyahu, right? And certainly it's false to suggest that his opposition is somehow religious, right? That's just totally ridiculous. Now, it's also the case that many religious right-wingers smartly, in their mind, adopted political versions of opposition to the peace process because that was a more compelling narrative with which to create coalitions than saying Yasser Arafat metaphysically cannot be sincere. Now, as I always like to say, right, Arafat made that easier by being a horrible human being and a liar, right? So it enabled them, right, it actually enabled them to plausibly say, oh, our opposition to Arafat is that he's horrible and insincere. But in fact, I think for many of them, what's going on is actually metaphysics, not politics. So I guess what I'm actually saying is twofold, right? One is that I'm not sure that what religious right people say should always be taken at face value. I think it depends a lot on who they're talking to. But also, a lot of American journalists who really don't know anything about Zionist thought or Israeli intellectual life, a lot of those people talk about the right in Israel as if it's this sort of one unified monolith, and it's easier to demonize it by just imagining that it's messianic and deluded, as opposed to, even if one thinks it's wrong, actually acknowledging its fear, which is real, and as you yourself have written, when you know something about who Hamas is and you're not willing to lie about that, that fear is not crazy, right? Again, whatever conclusion you reach, right? So I think in both contexts, one needs to do more teasing out than is often done. Is that a better answer to your question?
Yeah, but what you seem to be implying by not saying is they don't actually make these arguments in a political context. They stick to that security argument
They don't make them
because it's more useful.
Oh, because
they don't believe it.
Yeah, exactly.
They
because
don't talk to each other. The people
right.
who believe it talk to each other with that frame of reference, and the people who have a different outlook, they don't argue basic principles, they bargain.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. There's a small segment, I guess, of the religious Zionist world that said, most of these people were on the left, not surprisingly, that said, you know, when you guys invoke in political conversations that God gave us the land, don't you understand that when you talk to secular people, that's a non-starter? Like, what are they supposed to say to that? Right? And so...
Well, but it's interesting because Rick Santorum and a large part of the American book...
We're going to end in one second.
Does say that. In this country, even though
right.
it's a similar concept. And yet you would think in Israel, that would be even more powerful than you're saying it's
Russia. I think that's actually true. In other words, I think that most of the Israeli population would laugh at, let's say, Sarah Palin's version of Christian Zionism as an actual worldview. Whether they think it's useful to be nice to her is a different question, right? That's a political question. But that metaphysical set of assumptions, totally the non-starter for most of the Israeli population. That's what I'm not sure that Andrew Sullivan and people like him get at all. Anyway, thank you very much.